Welcome to Special Sauce, Serious Eats podcast about food and life. Every week on Special Sauce, we talk to some of the leading lights of American culture, food folks and non-food folks alike.
We had a segment on the Today Show when the first book came out based on the 20 worst foods in America. We had put the silver domes over the food equivalents of 2,200 calories. And in this case, it was 14 Krispy Kreme donuts. And so when you tell somebody, if you eat those cheese fries, you are eating 14 Krispy Kreme donuts, the entire studio exploded, and that book became an instant bestseller.
This week, we are joined by writer and co-founder of one of our favorite websites, Roads and Kingdoms, Matt Goulding. Like his site, Matt covers the world of food and travel in mouth-watering, evocative fashion. His new book is called Pasta, Pane, Vino. Wow, I got that right. I'm so proud. And as serious eaters can tell from the title, he explores the subject of Italian food and travel in his typically unique fashion. Welcome to Special Sauce, Matt Goulding.
Ed, my man, thank you so much for having me on.
As they say on The Fan, first-time caller, big fan.
I am on. Honestly, I'm super excited to be here because I am sort of a it feels like a lifelong Ed Levine nerd.
That's hard to believe. Not even my wife would say that.
Probably not, but I've been geeking out on your stuff for quite some time, my friend. So to be here at the table on the microphone with you is indeed an honor.
Oh, well, thank you very much. Well, there's so many things I want to talk to you about, but we're going to end up in Italy and Spain and Japan. But first, we're going to go into the Wayback Machine and ask you about the Goulding table growing up.
The Goulding table growing up. Well, let me start by saying the Goulding table was a Midwestern meat and potatoes table.
Okay.
Both my mom and dad were raised in the Midwest. My mom in Michigan. My father, well, in Texas. But neither of them were adventurous eaters. They both grew up in massive Catholic families. My mom was one of 10. My dad is one of 9. So, you know, it was a matter of getting food on the table, getting people fed, getting them to bed, you know, sustenance, essentially, to keep the engines running.
What chaos must have...
Oh, you can only imagine. I can only imagine because it's hard to wrap your arms around that idea these days.
And did you have that many aunts and uncles growing up?
I did. My family is... massive. I can't remember names. I couldn't invite him to my wedding because it would literally be like a 1,000-person wedding. I have 472 cousins. It's a beautiful mess, but it's a mess. Unfortunately, part of what grew out of that mess was a very limited diet at the Goulding table.
Sure.
My mom, bless her heart, doesn't touch seafood, doesn't eat a number of different vegetables. Even just the word of lamb or goat makes her recoil in disgust. And so this was kind of an impossible story of, that is to say, my love for food. Maybe it was some sort of teenage rebellion that grew out of sort of the contrarian approach to, you know, do exactly the opposite of what your parents say. You know, most parents are saying, eat your vegetables and have some fish and some heart healthy fats. And my mom was like, here's some potatoes. Here's some meat. Have at it.
Have at it.
So
it wasn't gracious dining, was it?
It wasn't. But, you know, of course, there are nice, warm, nostalgic memories of certain casseroles and a handful of go-to dishes. My dad, I should say, was, as many men are, was a great griller and was great with eggs.
Really?
It seems to be two things that men generally feel comfortable cooking, even in a relatively limited culinary household.
Could he softly scramble an egg?
He could scramble a really soft egg. He can make a weeping sort of omelet without even knowing who Jacques Pepin is, you know, it's just like sort of lucked into this talent. But that those food memories do really carry over. So I am grateful for those.
So one of the things I really want to ask you about is like your family's travel itineraries. Because like in my case, the furthest we ever traveled from our house in Long Island was to Hershey, Pennsylvania.
Well, so if I missed the culinary gene in terms of the family lottery, I got the travel gene. My mother was a travel agent. Growing up, and I am the youngest of four boys, and they bravely ventured out into the world with us. You know, hell or high water every year was you save, you save, you save, and you go on an adventure. And so When I was 8 years old, I was on my way to Fiji and then to New Zealand.
Fascinating.
Then to, you know, Central America, you know, incredible places. I was way too young and stubborn and foolish, like every 8-year-old or 10-year-old kid in the world, to truly appreciate it. But nevertheless, the seeds were planted.
The seeds were most assuredly planted. You went a lot further than Hershey, PA.
Dude, Hershey, PA? No. No. I was like, you know, the Auckland, New Zealand, and some weird island I can't pronounce. And it was a very charmed lifestyle in those regards. It was one trip a year, but it was always ambitious. It was always far-flung. And it made a hell of an impression on me, and particularly my next youngest brother after me, who is just a world wanderer, a guy who has seen more of the world than all of us combined and has sort of helped continue on in the tradition of Goulding nomads.
Yeah. And this was in California, right? You grew up in California?
Exactly. I grew up in Northern California, and then I moved to North Carolina when I was 14 years old. So I got a taste of, you know, of the Deep South, or at least the sort of Middle South, as well as the West Coast.
And what did your dad do for a living?
My father was an insurance salesman, but he... when we moved to North Carolina, he had just been diagnosed with Crohn's disease, which turns out I also have. And I was diagnosed about a year later and comes from both sides of my family. And so kind of the two ironies of my food life is one that I come from a family that didn't really value food. And the other is that I ended up being deeply in love with this world of food, but nevertheless have a digestive illness.
Right.
That presents all these interesting challenges.
Wow.
And you know, new adventures out there for me.
So how did you end up a writer? Did you write in college?
I did. I wrote at the UCLA Daily Bruin.
Which is a fine daily student newspaper.
It's an excellent student newspaper. And, you know, I was cooking and I was traveling and I was writing. And there was some job, some life was going to grow out of that. And I'd gone to culinary school for a little bit in northern Spain. I'd come back to L.A. and was cooking in some decent restaurants there on the west side. And I was still 20, 21 years old.
So this was during college?
This was during college.
This
is sort of the later years in college.
I didn't know that. So you were actually in the kitchen.
I was in the kitchen. I had my first cooking, real culinary, culinary job. My first cooking job was at an institution in downtown Raleigh called 41st Street Oyster Bar. And a classic sort of Southern fry style restaurant serving 800 people a day, and I ran the hush puppy gun originally. I mean, it really is a gun.
That's a station, the hush puppy station.
The hush puppy station, when every single one of those tables gets a big basket of hush puppies and some melted butter to dip them into. Let's just say, when you run that station, you go home every night with just welts on your arms.
Yeah, sure.
But somewhere along the way, cooking, you know, between there and I moved to South America, and I was cooking down in Patagonia for a spell when I was just graduated from college.
Wow.
It was great, and it was an incredible thing to be able to do, but I realized that I wasn't really made. I didn't have the DNA of a lifelong chef. Mm-hmm. You know, I had this romantic vision that being a cook meant, you know, improvising meals and constantly coming up with new ideas. And I realized that the reality is much more circumscribed than that. It is, you're going to cook 35 fillets of salmon tonight. You're going to fry this many soft-shell crabs. You're going to do these things night in, night out. And, you know, of course, the rarefied class of chef moves on to this, to embody the romantic ideal of creative cooking. But most people are out there just working a really demanding physical job.
Right.
And it felt like, okay, why don't I save the cooking for me and for loved ones and take the writing thing and move it into the kitchen? You know, use that as my lens, use that as my sort of entryway into a world that's really hard to survive in.
So how did you make that transition?
Well, I had, I should say that it started with my last course at UCLA, my college professor of my creative writing workshop. I've been writing these sort of tortured short stories the entire semester and had been, you know, with varying degrees of success. And finally, I wrote the last story about Thanksgiving, about a particular Thanksgiving that we had improvised in college on the streets of Westwood and Western, you know, in Western Los Angeles. And she pulled me aside at the end of the class and just said, from now on, write about food. You know, this other stuff you're trying to do, like parallel narratives and other, like, literary tricks, like, you're probably not cut out for that.
You are not Colson Whitehead.
Right, exactly. Let it go. Let it go. Tell us about the turkey. You know, describe the smell of the roasting sage. And so that was a, you know, it was really extraordinary advice. And so I was lucky enough to have met somebody on campus that ran a magazine called Student Traveler that at the time was distributed at like 1,200 university campuses across the country.
It was one of those freebies. Yeah.
A freebie, but it was done extremely well. Yeah. And Jeff Booth was his name. He was the editor then. And there was a guy named Matt Gross who went on to become the Frugal Traveler at the New York Times.
Sure.
And so it was a small but potent team, and these guys taught me a lot about writing and editing magazines.
Wow.
And so I that was sort of my entryway into actually being paid for writing.
Right.
You know, 10 cents a word, but it was a check, and it was a drug. It was, you know, immediately there was this high of seeing your name in print, being able to tell your story. You know, anyone who's deranged and narcissistic enough to become a writer knows what that high feels like.
Right,
you know?
Absolutely.
And I was hooked pretty quickly.
And how did you end up at Men's Health?
It's a very strange path because I went from being this sort of assistant editor at this, you know, Student Traveler publication and to being realizing very quickly that, listen, if you want to make it in this world, you got to go to New York. You got to find a way in there. And so I became an intern at Harper's Magazine, which is, you know, one of the golden grails of literary sort of magazine internships out there, and, you know, worked underneath Lewis Lapham in sort of the last days of his career at that magazine, and was, you know, it was a very, very different editorial world than writing about food or travel.
Wow.
But it was, that to me was serious writing.
Yes, that's very heady stuff.
Right, and I, you know, as somebody who wanted to write fiction like every young writer, this was the closest thing to that in the magazine world. And, you know, my internship was coming to a close, and I was, you know, they were going to offer me a job as an editorial assistant there, and I got an email from the same Matt Gross who had, you know, had shepherded my sort of early career at Student Traveler and said, how do you feel about Emmaus? And I said, what is an Emmaus? Like, I didn't even know what this word was. It turns out that it's a small town in Pennsylvania where Rodale Publishing Company lives and breathes, and where Men's Health is based. And so suddenly I found my way out to Emmaus as the magazine sort of only interested food kind of dude. This is sort of right when food was becoming cool. This is right when you guys were really digging your fingers into the digital world of food, you know, when I was sort of beginning to really geek out on the stuff that you guys were doing online. And realize, wait a second, you guys have been running this massive magazine that's read by 2 million men a month, and you're still talking about eating broccoli for your prostate. Like, can we get past that? You know, and it took people a long time to understand what that meant. And finally, at an editorial meeting, I think I said something that, I got to talk to these really smart editors, but in their language. And I said, you know, the kitchen is the new garage. And it was like, that somehow registered, like men should be in the kitchen,
right?
You know, rolling up their sleeves, figuring things out,
tinkering. You attach the kitchen to a male bastion,
right? Exactly. And it, you know, it was a really simple move to make for them as a magazine. Food as lifestyle, food as a way to sort of live and breathe on a day to day, and also take care of yourself. So
I think that's when you and I first talked. I don't know if you were doing something on something I had done or something on Serious Seats. You and I had kind of interaction. I can't remember what it was.
There was. I can't remember what
it was. The pizza book?
It may have been the pizza book. And I remember you had done a couple of sort of, you played the role of the expert in the classic Men's Health, you know, formatted article style that we'd always do.
Yeah.
And so here's Ed telling us, you know, what the upskirt shot of a pizza really means,
right,
or things like that.
Right.
Or define cornicione for
you
know?
And there
was, but you know, it was that type of material that you guys were doing that I really wanted to just find a way to do in this big glossy magazine that had incredible resources and a really big name that opened up doors because people wanted to be in a magazine read by 2 million people a month.
Sure.
And so, you know, that the moment was right. It was a very fortuitous sort of serendipitous moment to find myself in Emmaus, Pennsylvania.
Yeah. What's weird is you then wrote those books with, I guess, the editor-in-chief, Dave Zizanko.
Yeah, that's right. DZ.
But the weird thing is those books are so far away from what you do now. You're probably fine with that because it was like, hey, it was a way to get co-author credit on a book.
I mean, a very wild time because I had just written a long piece in the magazine, my first big feature, about going down to Brazil to see a shaman there to kind of try to help heal this Crohn's disease issue of mine.
Wow.
And the conclusion of this story was kind of like, I need to basically take matters into my own hands, simplify my life. A lot of these messages we're trying to pass on to the male readership of Men's Health. And the reaction of DZ, the editor-in-chief, who I didn't even think knew who I was at that time, was to ask me to write a series of books with him.
He was one of the sort of seminal editors as rock stars.
Big time. Big time. He lived the lifestyle. He was, you know, a regular fixture on the Today Show. He was, you know, a guy kind of very, very, very much intertwined with the New York magazine culture of the day. And still is. You know, and I was very grateful for Dave to give me this opportunity. But, you know, it was like, well, okay, you want to write a book? Well, what's the book? And he said, well, we got to figure it out. But the title is Eat This, Not That. I'm like, well, that's...
I love it. He'd say he's such a high-concept guy that all he knew was the title.
It was a brilliant four words.
Right.
That convergence of syllables was extraordinary. It really was. And, you know, we put together this first book and... 3 months, maybe less. And it was about, you know, every day of your life is filled with dozens of food decisions. And if you learn to just make a few better decisions, rather than restructuring your entire life around, you know, simply fast-burning carbs or slow-burning carbs or you know, healthy fats or, you know, whatever the diet du jour is, just learn to make a few smarter decisions, you know, if that means... you know, having this salad instead of that one, drinking this beer instead of the other one. It was a very simple message, but we had no idea how this thing was going to do, and we had a segment on the Today Show when the first book came out, and we had, the segment was based on the 20 worst foods in America.
And I'm sure it was exactly 2 minutes long.
It was, I think it was 2 minutes and 37 seconds or
okay.
something. But, so we, you know, we got those extra 37 seconds, which we used to basically present these, you know, extraordinary calorie bombs from fast food and, you know, sit-down restaurants, chains across America. And we had one very simple idea because, you know, I could tell you, the average viewer in America, that the Aussie cheese fries, which at the time were the worst food in America, have 2,200 calories. And that's maybe sounds like a lot. But next to that plate on the Today Show, as Dave was doing this presentation to Matt Lauer, we had put these silver domes over the food equivalents of that 2,200 calories. And in this case, it was 14 Krispy Kreme donuts. And so when you tell somebody, if you eat those cheese fries, you are eating 14 Krispy Kreme donuts, the entire studio exploded. Matt Lauer lost his shit. And that book became an instant bestseller.
And right, like as in 10 million copies, right?
We did 18 books in about 7 years. I remember at one point we would go on Amazon and the top 10 would have 5 Eat This Not That books on it. I mean, it was just silly stuff. I mean, it was really hard to sort of metabolize all these things that were happening because you're right, it wasn't where my natural sort of relationship with food is certainly as a writer resides, but it was an opportunity. And when you got it, you do it, and you do it as well as you possibly can. And I think Dave and I made a series of books that had, you know, that had a lot of really positive things about them, you know?
That's great. And were you a writer for hire, or did you get involved in royalties?
I got involved in royalties.
That's
and that
a
was
beautiful
a,
thing.
That was, in a, I was kind of nervous about asking for it because
right.
here I was 27 years old, and Dave was a big name, and he could have just paid someone, cut him a check for $25,000, and that was it. But, you know, I said, listen, you know, give me a couple of points on this, and let's just see what happens. And my life was changed by that significantly.
That's fantastic. What a great story. So you were the food editor at Men's Health. And first of all, Eat This, Not That is the greatest four-word elevator pitch ever.
it's so good.
Right?
It's so good.
You know exactly what it is. It's rhythmically perfect.
Exactly.
Right? It's not iambic pentameter, but it's damn close.
Even the spacing of the words on the cover lined up so perfectly. It was like the first cover had a Big Mac and a Whopper on it. And this was the Big Mac at 540 calories, and that was the Whopper at 730. And that's 190 calories that you save, but visually and contextually, every part about it was just explosive. You know? So it was... It was a hell of a heady time, honestly.
Yeah. And you stayed there for a couple of years?
I was at Men's Health for about 6 years. I burnt out writing these books, basically, you know, as anybody would. I probably didn't, no exaggeration, was working these 20-hour days every day for the better part of those 6 years. And finally, I just said, you know, we've done an incredible thing here. This has been a wonderful ride, but I've done as much as I can possibly do with this magazine. And I've learned a lot. I learned so much for the smart and very smart people that worked at that magazine, mm-hmm. about the economy of words, about the importance of meaningful service, about counterintuitive information and how valuable that is as a writer, especially as one who's working with information that, you know, you want the reader to be able to sort of immediately put into use in their
lives.
Right,
and more now than ever before in this age of an explosion of information coming at people, the value of counterintuitive information that turns out to be right is a game changer.
It is absolutely a game changer. And Dave was a genius in those regards, and I learned quite a bit at his side. And so, you know, here we have it. You have my first, you know, professional magazine experience was working under Lewis Lapham, who wrote his edit letter at Harper's was like 18,000 words long.
Right, and you had to go to your dictionary, to the OED, for 17 words.
You really did. You know, you really did. Old school magazine guy, martini drinking, super wise, but was a stylist.
Right.
First and foremost. And Dave Zinczenko was...
the polar opposite.
It really was about delivering potent batches of information that's going to shock or provoke...
a response.
A response. Yeah. And inspire and do a number of other things. But those were the two extremes. And it just felt like somewhere in between there is something really interesting and fun to work with. And so I left New York. I was, you know, at this point was barely standing, essentially, you know, between the work and some of these health challenges. I said, you know, I got to get out of here. I got to just go. I'm going to go to Italy. I'm going to, you know, go to Bologna. I'm going to, you know, eat a lot of great food and learn Italian and meet a beautiful Italian woman. Totally original idea. No one has ever once thought about this idea in America, especially not writers. But so I had this incredibly original idea, and I'm like, I'm going to go chase this thing. And I stopped over in Barcelona on my way. This is 2010 in the fall, and I had studied abroad in Barcelona. And so I was like, well, I'm going to go through Spain, just say hi to this country and reconnect with this old city that I had loved, you know, as a study abroad student. And on my last day there, I was in a bar and I met a young, lovely Catalan woman, and I never left. That was it.
So you had everything right. It just, you had the wrong country.
That's exactly right. I'm right? Like, wait, I'm going to go learn Italian. I already speak Spanish. I'm going to go over there and try to eat pasta, but I really love jamón more than prosciutto. Like, what am I thinking? I mean, it was almost that simple. But, you know, Barcelona is an incredible place, and she, Laura, was and is an incredible woman. She's now my wife. We live in the middle of Barcelona, and she's born and raised just outside of the city itself. It was exactly what I needed. Exactly what I, you know, I have no right to be as fortunate as I've been in these situations, but it all came together.
Sometimes the world delivers.
Yeah, sometimes the world delivers.
But you know, it's funny about, I was in Barcelona in 2010, I think. And this is when I really began to really understand the power of the internet. I posted on Serious Eats, this when it was very personal. There wasn't very much, it was still more my stuff than recipe and technique stuff.
Right,
and I
said,
I'm going to Barcelona, and I went to the Boqueria yesterday, and I'm just overwhelmed by the number of hams, and I need, can anybody make sense of ham for me, of jamón in Barcelona? And within an hour, I got a bunch of responses.
Wow.
I'm a ham wholesaler in Barcelona. This is what you need to know. There's 3J, there's this, there's that. And I was just like, this thing is so powerful. It's like so far beyond what I ever imagined.
So powerful. So powerful. I mean, you guys really tapped into a zeitgeist. And I'm not saying this to, you know, blow smoke up your rear here on your own show, but, you know, I was geeking out on a hamburger today and slice and everything that you guys did and the vernacular that you brought into the conversation and the geekiness, the unabashed geekiness that was brought to these things that most people deem trivial, but like, goddamn, this is culture. This is ours.
Yes.
And we're not going to apologize to anybody. In fact, we're going to dissect this down to a molecular level.
Yes, and have fun doing it and poke fun at ourselves.
Exactly. And that was a magical thing. And that was really liberating as, I think, as a writer and as an editor and just thinking about, okay, what do I want to do with food, you know? And for a while I just felt like, I'm going to do food until I can do something serious, you know? One of these days I'm going to get past food and get into something real.
Right.
And like, what's more real than food? Like, and so rather than moving past food, I just moved food, for me personally, I just broadened
Absolutely.
My viewpoint there.
Yes.
And looked at this as, you know, really an extraordinary lens through which to explore the most, you know, captivating contours of the world.
You know, I used to say about Trillin, Calvin Trillin, you're just a great writer who writes about food. After reading your books, you know, it really made me realize that you're just a great writer who writes about food and tries to place it in a larger context and does it in a really natural way.
I truly appreciate that. And that means a lot coming from you, Ed. You know, it's just, as someone who was naturally drawn to just movement, I'm like, you know, the shark, I stop moving, I die. And
right.
In Spain, they call me a culo inquieto. It means literally a restless ass.
Yeah, that was that great line in the pasta bowl.
Yeah, and I can't stop moving. And so one thing I realized, it's going to be a really lonely life unless I find a way to connect with people as quickly as possible. And it's always, in every single instance, food, no matter where you are, was just an instant entry point into a culture, into someone's home, into their lives. And it happened over and over again. And so to be able to share those stories in some way, just it would be stupid not to, you know? And so really what happened was, I was living in Barcelona and I'd been thinking for a while about, okay, you know, done this version of the nutrition, kind of impactful service-based stuff. I've done some of the longer form stuff. I had met an editor at Time magazine, Nathan Thornburg. He was international editor at Time for many years and a really, really, really smart guy. He was kind of going through his own sort of existential editorial crisis of, I love politics, I love all these elements about it, but I don't want to tell the formatted, formulaic stories that a magazine like Time.
There is nothing more formatted and formulaic than writing for Time magazine.
Right, and it's a brilliant platform, and it has an incredible place in the canon of, you know, American journalism. But he was as desperate to break away from that format as I was from that of service journalism. And we sat down, and you know, I was on assignment, one of my last assignments for Men's Health. I was down in Mexico doing a story that eventually was titled "There Are No Nachos in Mexico." And, you know, Nathan had come over. He had been thrown out of Cuba by the Cuban government because they found out he was a journalist. He had washed up in Mexico City. We went out to one of these smoked meat emporiums on the outskirts of Mexico City on a Sunday and had a bunch of barbacoa and pulque and hatched this plan. You know, let's combine your political world of foreign correspondence, my world of sort of food and culture, because God knows, like, we need more food and politics, and we need more politics and food, and we need to tell the stories behind the story that most publications just don't have the bandwidth to do. And let's just give this thing a shot. And that was really the genesis of Roads and Kingdoms.
Yeah, wow.
That was it.
And so I'm curious, because I have my own horror stories about what it was like trying to get a website off the ground, especially in 2006. You know, I'm writing a sort of business memoir about Serious Eats.
Oh, excellent, excellent.
I'm most of the way through it now, but there's a chapter that I titled, It's Going to Be Great, because that's all. That was the only thing I could tell would be investors, because there was nothing. It was like, I had no, oh, it's just going to be like so-and-so. You know, it's like, no, it's just going to be great.
I mean, what was there to compare it to?
There was nothing to compare it to.
But were you nevertheless able to entice these investors? Was it's going to be great enough to get them to open up their pocketbooks?
I will tell you something. And I'm one of four boys too. I'm the youngest, and my oldest brother, who had adopted me when my parents died when I was a kid, had been successful at many things as an academic, as an airline executive. And, you know, he said, well, you know, why don't you, I'd invest something if you brought me a business plan that could withstand my scrutiny, which of course is a big deal with him. And so I must have taken 50 business plans to him.
Wow.
And finally, one summer's day in 2005, I guess it was, no, it was 2006. And he said, you know what? I don't really understand what you're talking about. I don't really understand this. I have no idea if this is going to work. This is so far afield from what I've done in my life. And he'd done a lot of things in his life,
yeah.
Right? But he said, you know what? I could tell how important this is to you, and so I'm going to do it. And that was it. And he was a very difficult man, and I love him to pieces. And we went through many ups and downs during Sirius Seats' independent tenure before we sold it. And I realize, as we're talking about this, that it was an act of kindness and generosity and love because
right. As
it was criminally irresponsible to actually expect somebody to pony up money for this.
There's no other way to interpret that act.
Yes.
I mean, there could be no more clear, potent act of love than to invest in a digital food venture.
Right.
Let's be honest here.
So how did you guys do it?
From an investment standpoint, we started very, very small and very humbly. We self-funded. We literally launched...
With savings.
And we literally launched on Tumblr. We were, for the first like 4 or 5 months of existence, we were just a Tumblr.
You know, he was my first chief technology officer.
Oh, really?
David Karp.
I didn't know this.
Yes, it's somehow been erased from his
biography. That's a huge piece, man.
But it is true. Tumblr was developed for Sirius Eats, and he said, look, I'm going to sell it to other verticals.
Come on.
Yes, yes.
Oh,
and he
man.
Was, by the way, he was 18.
Yeah, he was.
And he did okay.
An impressive young man.
Yeah.
A very impressive young man. And we just thought, well, this thing is kind of new and shiny and interesting, and maybe we can hack this format some way. And, you know, the third sort of co-founder was a lifelong friend of mine named Doug Humanic, who was a designer. And, you know, we're like, well, let's just try this because it's free and we don't really know who or what we are quite yet. And so we went to, you know, the original idea was we were just going to travel around the world together and do these really high concentrated reporting trips. And so we started in Burma in 2011. And this is when Hillary Clinton was traveling over there as Secretary of State, the first time an American diplomat had been there in 30 or 40 years. And it represented a place that had the perfect intersection of roads and kingdoms interests, geopolitics, incredible food that had been talked about very little in the mainstream because of, you know, Burma's sort of closed off stature on a global scale. It had interesting music, and it just felt like, let's just spend 10 days on the ground going every which direction, reporting our asses off and see what we come up with.
Right.
And that was the impetus, you know, and we did that. Later on, we went to Peru, and then we went to Denmark, we went to South Africa, very different places with very different DNA, but what they all shared in common was that kind of intersection.
And you posted them on Tumblr.
And we posted them on Tumblr, and like we got like, we were just talking about this today actually, we would get like two comments, and it'd be one from Nathan's mom and one from my mom.
I know full well my brother was often the sole commenter on Ed Levine Eats.
Oh my God.
Which was the precursor to Sirius.
Amazing. Because, you know, it's funny because, you know, Nathan was up in, you know, he was always doing the kind of harder, you know, foreign correspondence stories. He was up in the northern Kachin state where sort of a long civil war has been going on.
In Burma.
And been reporting on this on the ground, precarious circumstances. And he posts this beautiful piece about this conflict up there on Tumblr, which, you know, most people posting 12 sentences, you know, 12
right.
word sentences
about
and a
Beyonce.
Beautiful picture. Right. And he posts this huge long report from up there, and it gets one comment from my mom, and it says, "Tell Matt to call me." You know, are you kidding me? You know, is this where we're going from? You know, he gave up his job as international editor of Time magazine. I gave up whatever I was doing, and here's my mom looking for me to call her on Tumblr.
So were you paying yourself salaries?
At the beginning, no, we weren't.
Wow.
We weren't. And so we worked just looking to find, to establish some kind of voice, some kind of position in, you know, in the media world that we thought was pretty unique at the mm-hmm. time. And
it was, and it still is.
And, you know, we eventually moved out of Tumblr and found an actual website and built it out, I think, in the spring of 2012. So we're basically 6 years old now, but...
And you have some outside investors, right?
Well, we have one.
Tony?
We have one outside investor. So, you know, we were on one of these trips in Denmark, actually, and we were staying on a houseboat because it was the cheapest place to stay, right next to Noma. And, you know, we had spent a couple of days with Noma in the kitchen, with Renee and those guys, and... You know, we're still just wondering, like, who the hell is reading this stuff? You know, our numbers are just infinitesimally small. Like, it's not possible to be getting less page views than we're getting right now. You know,
I used to say the high two figures on a good day.
Oh, man, exactly. That's what it felt like. It was more or less like that. And, you know, and we were reporting our asses off. Like I said, we were, I thought, writing some good pieces. But we had no idea who was reading us, if anyone, beyond, you know, this... Some tiny little numbers we were looking at.
And you had no sort of web genius.
Zero.
Amidst your
nothing.
Crew.
We had nothing. We were like, wait, what is SEO? Is like a conference for basketball.
Right.
We'll call
See,
it basketball,
I,
you know?
I hooked up early on with Adam Kuban.
Yeah, you
and
guys.
And Meg Hourihan and Elena Brown and
You
many,
guys had it.
Yeah, because I knew nothing.
Yeah, you know, we knew nothing, but we didn't have the wherewithal to find someone who actually did know something.
Right.
We just kept... writing these like 5,000 word narrative pieces about the most random convergence of culture and politics that we could find. But we woke up one in the morning on this houseboat after a long night out at Noma, and it was clear looking at my phone and Nathan looking at his, like something was happening. Like the phone was like literally like, you know, pulsating or something. And opened up the phone and it turns out that, you know, Anthony Bourdain had just sent out a tweet, and it said, it was very simple, but it said, "These guys do consistently fine work." And it was just a link to Rosen Kingdom's homepage. And that was it, you know, like, at least at that moment in time, that was it.
It was a game changer.
It was. It was, you know, for morale, obviously, it was an extraordinary dose, you know, of good vibes for us to know, okay, so he's reading, and that means everything to us, you know, because obviously what we do shares a lot of DNA with Tony's world, and did from the beginning. And obviously he's been an inspiration from that perspective of using food to go deeper and deeper into cultures around the world. And, you know, we kind of like, we played it cool. We didn't really, you know, what do you do with that information?
Right.
You know, you share it with the world and then you kind of move on, you keep doing your stuff. And that's what we did. And we kept writing and reporting. And, you know, we started noticing, this is right when Tony made the jump over to CNN, but in his first season at Parts Unknown, he went to, in sequence, basically, to Burma, to Peru, to Sicily, to South Africa,
like, this
and
dude's
to Denmark.
Like stealing our shit, man.
Like, I think he's following us. And, you know, he actually says it himself these days, so I'm not afraid to say that.
Sure.
But, and so basically, you know, I ended up in, you know, flash forward about a year, and I just gotten married, and I was in Japan on an extended honeymoon, and I was falling deeply in love with this cuisine and my new wife in equal measure. And I was just like, you know, I really got to do something. I want to write something bigger than a series of articles. And before going there, I had been looking for a book, you know. And, you know, when you're at the bookstore and you're like, I'm going to this place and I want some information, but I really want to just read a deep tale that's going to help me connect and contextualize what I'm going to experience over there. And so what do you do normally? Well, if you're going to go to Vietnam, maybe you get the Lonely Planet Vietnam and you buy Graham Greene's, you know, The Quiet American.
Right.
Or whatever. And you kind of fuse these two things to get your culture and your information. I just thought, well, damn it. Like, I just want one place where I could tell really great stories that give you information that's useful, but more than anything, gives you the context to have a deeper experience. And so I, you know, I was in Hokkaido after a crazy day of eating, and I just sort of took a moonshot and wrote Tony an email. I'd had met him, you know, a few months before, and just...
This is before he'd invested.
This is before he invested. This is before we had
right.
no contact whatsoever, but I had his email address, and I'd just been holding that card for a while, and I finally just said, hey, you know, I think you know who we are. I really appreciate, you know, the tweet. Those like six words or whatever it was, like, changed things for us. So thank you very much for that. And by the way, I'm like thinking about writing a book about Japan, you know, and this is the idea for the book. you know, thank you very much for your time and consideration, Mr. Bourdain. And, you know, went to bed thinking, okay, well, I had to send it,
right.
But that's that.
That's a Hail Mary,
you know,
there.
That's a Hail Mary. It was. It was a Hail Mary, but, like, by the time I woke up, he had written a very thoughtful and lovely response that was basically, yes, but what else can we do? Like, I want in some way. You know, how else can I be involved with you guys? And so, you know, of course, I was doing my end zone dance across the bed there in Hokkaido. Like, holy shit, this is extraordinary. So, you know, Tony came on as our first and only investor. I guess it would have been early 2014. And obviously, you know, that is an extraordinary privilege to be able to be invited into that world and sort of, you know, collaborate on ideas both big and small.
Yeah, and it's a door opener in so many ways, obviously.
And I got to say, you know, there was never any conversation about, okay, what's your guys' business model? What's your traffic look like? Can I see?
Fascinating.
Nothing. It was really, I love what you guys do. I trust the voice. I want to be a part of that. Let's do it.
That was it. That's so interesting because a lot of people that I talk to would always say, I love Serious Eats, but I really have to talk to my business manager.
Right.
Because that's the typical response of a well-known person who has made a lot of money, who reaches out and says, I like what you do. And every time, by the way, I realized that's a no.
Right. Yeah. I'll get back to you.
Right.
I'll get back to you.
This sounds really good. Can you just send some stuff to my financial advisors? Like, that's a no.
And if Tony had a business guy that he turned to in these situations, it never would have happened. He would have been like, you're fucking crazy. These guys are going to bankrupt you. You know? Do not do this deal. Thankfully, Tony has a really small team. It's basically Tony, you know?
Right.
Like,
yes.
He's basically, of course, he works and collaborates with ZPZ and a lot of very smart people. But at the end of the day, you know,
Tony makes the calls.
It's Anthony Bourdain, and that's it.
Yeah.
And it's unlike a lot of these other, like you mentioned, very large food personalities who have just massive teams that stretch on for blocks and blocks, you know. They have people. They're people surrounded by people. And, you know, you got people to talk to you about every little nuance of every conversation. And that's never been the way. It's just been, guys, just keep doing what you're doing. Now maybe I can just, you know, I won't be stealing from you. I'm actually just, you know, we're all kind of
we're
doing this together. We're collaborating. And it was, you know, it was a remarkable change in fortune for us.
And that's the only money you've had to take in?
That's it.
Are you close to self-sustaining?
We are. Knock on wood, 2018 looks to be a very good year for us. We'll definitely be
a profitable
company. Imagine that. You know, along the way, we had all these kinds of soul-searching business moments that you had yourself for years and years is, who are we trying to be? How do we monetize? How do we grow? Do we take an investment? And I think right after Tony came on, especially, it was like, now that we have the biggest fish in the sea, we can go get great money.
Exactly.
Because at that moment, this is in 2013, 14, you know, suddenly Silicon Valley was just throwing dump trucks of cash at people in the media industry.
And websites weren't a four-letter word at the time.
Right, exactly. There was this like 2 or 3 year period where money was just like falling from the sky. And it would have been really easy to get money cheap at that moment. But we still just decided, you know what, like, we don't want that. We don't want to invite anyone else into this very small, abstract, perhaps, you know, unsuccessful in the long run party, but it'll still be our party, you know?
Yes, you need that. You know, one of the things that my brother used to say to me, he said, no matter how desperate you get, Ed, he said, never sell too much of the company so that you and I do not own 51%.
That's right. And that's a tremendous, tremendous advice. And, you know, that's never say never, but in general, we've taken on the posture that we want to continue to grow at the rate that our means allow us to, you know, and that means, you know, we've been lean for the better part of our history.
You have like 10 full-time employees?
About that right now.
And you're advertiser supported?
We have a bit of advertising, but on rosenkingdoms.com, it's, you know, it's kind of slim pickings. We have something with Trivago and some stuff like that. But One of the things that really helped us, you know, we've done some of the branded content work that everyone does, and that's, you know, that's always a slice of the pie for the digital, you know, the digital success. But we came to CNN and basically said, you know, listen, you guys have, you know, this massively successful show. Tony, at that point, you know, after a couple seasons of Parts Unknown, was really one of the, especially with the, you know, with the hot age group from 25 to 40, was the biggest thing they had going. And said, but you guys have the most ugly, god-awful website, when this really could be an incredible digital entryway into his world. You know, let us work with you to build, you know, PartsUnknown.com. Well, unfortunately, PartsUnknown.com is owned by, like, a coat seller in the Midwest. It sells, like, pantyhose and, like, raincoats. And, like, for all the money in the world, they were not going to give away PartsUnknown.com. And so we gave up on that, and we found ExplorePartsUnknown.com. Right. But basically, we collaborated with CNN. It's not part of CNN.com's, you know, monolith. Right. It's its own sort of island out there, and it basically takes episode by episode the Parts Unknown experience and brings it. It takes the conversations that Tony starts on those shows and really picks them up and continues them.
And do they pay you to develop that?
Yeah, so CNN has helped fund the development of that site, you know, but we share ownership over it, and it's done really well. You know, I mean, it was a no-brainer, because look at that intersection of Tony's world, and it's attractive for advertising because, you know, it's...
And it gets you more scale than you had, certainly.
A hell of a lot more scale. And, you know, if you had the massive CNN fire hose that as soon as they turn that on, it just blasts everything that you've ever done out of the water in 2 minutes because it's so huge.
Yeah.
But it's been, you know, I think both from an editorial standpoint and from a business standpoint, it's been, you know, a really remarkable opportunity.
Yeah, that's amazing. Well, Matt, we're going to have to leave it here in terms of part one of our interview, but since we haven't gotten to your new book or your old books, we're going to keep you here, hopefully not against your will, although we did lock the door. And we're going to cover those topics on part two.
Excellent. Look forward to it.
So long, Serious Eaters. We'll see you next time.